Welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Rick Pasek, and he'll be answering your most important questions on entomology in still waters. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we are broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Rick a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure to sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address in the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 24 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Rick about entomology for still waters. Our approach is simple, education. Fly Fusion is unique when it comes to fly fishing magazines. It's one of the few magazines in North America that focuses on instruction and education. In Fly Fusion, we've covered subjects like shortline nymphing, tactics for tough days, stillwater fly patterns, dry fly fishing for fussy trout, and a host of other interesting and educational topics. Visit our website today at www.flyfusionmag.com. That's www.flyfusionmag.com. And start your subscription to Fly Fusion today so you can learn all you need to know about fly fishing. Well, before we introduce Rick, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. So you have 2 chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and look for that link under Rick's section that says, click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. Thanks to Rick Pasek, we will also be giving away autographed copies of his books, The Freshman Fly Fisher and The Freshman Fly Fisher's Insect Guide. Now, here's how you can win those books. And by the way, Rick's offered 2 sets of those books. So if you win, you'll get both books, and there's going to be 2 winners tonight. So that's very nice of Rick to offer that, and you guys will be the lucky ones to get them. The question will be about something we talk about during the show tonight, and you must be the first person to submit your answer, in this case, first or second person, to submit your answer along with your name and location using the text box on our homepage. It's the same box that you'll use to submit questions during the show, and that's what we'll use at the end of the show, so use your best typing skills and be one of the first 2 with the correct answer. Our guest speaker tonight is Rick Pasek, and Rick began fishing as a toddler, learning from his father on the world-famous Bow River in Alberta. His passion for fly fishing earned him the title of Fly Fish Fanatic. Rick has spent countless hours practicing and honing his skills, both at casting and tying flies. And not content with simply going through the motions, Rick began studying entomology to properly understand and respect the science behind the sport. Most recently, Rick has become the author of Freshman Fly Fisher book series, providing easy-to-read information for new fly fishers, complete with handy illustrations and photos. The books cover all of the fly fishing basics and tactics and dispel any lingering myths about the sport, a sport Rick insists is really for everyone. Rick is a stillwater specialist who has shared his fly fishing knowledge and experience on the BC Outdoors Backroads Tour, in classrooms and trade shows, and on television and radio appearances, including National Weather Network, Breakfast TV, CBC Radio, and the award-winning Urban Rush. His work has been in BC Outdoor Magazine and can be found online in many fly fishing forums, and of course, at his popular website and blog, www.rp3flyfishing.com. Rick is a proud member and supporter of the groups such as the FFF, the BCFFF, Trout Unlimited, Canada, Fly BC, and Fishing with Rod. When he isn't fishing, teaching, or writing, Rick is expanding his vast knowledge of entomology and relaxing with his wife and son in his home in British Columbia, Canada. Rick, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Well, thank you very much. It's very nice to be here.
It's a good night to stay in and listen to Internet Radio. I don't know, I've just finished up a snowstorm here, so we're all cozy here, ready to go.
Yeah. Well, we have our typical Vancouver rain, so.
Rain, huh?
Oh, yeah.
The never-ending rain.
Yep. Yeah, that's for sure. We actually had snow this morning in April in Vancouver. That's unheard of.
Unheard of. Wow.
Yeah.
Crazy weather times. Anyway, tonight we're going to talk about entomology for still waters. And like Rick, this is his specialty. And so he's going to kind of try to give us as much as he can in the next hour and a half about the bugs in the soup, so to speak, and see how we can't work those still waters a bit better and get more results from our fishing there. So we got lots of questions tonight, Rick. Hope we can get through a lot of them. And
I think we should be able to go through quite most of them as long as we don't linger too long.
Yeah, so let's get started.
Good.
We've got, let's just start out talking about entomology. Why don't you just, tell us what entomology is and why it's important to us in fly fishing to start out with.
Well, basically entomology, the easiest way to explain it is the study of bugs, the study of insects, and that's what we're doing in fly fishing, is trying to imitate the feed that the trout are after, or that the fish are after in general. It's not only trout, there's a lot of fish out there that eat insects, so it's part of their diet, so you need to learn how to mimic these insects and the life cycles and just all the information you can about the bugs, right? The more you know about the bugs, the better luck you have with being able to catch fish. So basically, that's what entomology is in a nutshell. It's the study of insects.
Great. Well, Dan Crowthers in North Dakota asked, what should fly fishing people know about stillwater entomology that they do not and that you are surprised that they do not know?
Weird
question there. But.
Yeah, you know what? I understand what he was trying to say there. Basically, I think a lot of people, what they don't know and that they should know, is the movement of the insects, how the insects live in their world. If you don't understand how the insects live in their world, how they move, their life cycles, their just everything that they do, their life, that's something that you really need to know, and a lot of people don't. A lot of people know what a dragonfly looks like or a damselfly looks like or a chironomid, but they have no idea of how they actually live in their realm, in the water, right? So that's one big thing that I find a lot of people that they really need to learn is how they live in their world.
Basically, you're talking about their life cycle. And
well, not only their life cycle, but just there's different bugs live in different areas in the lake.
Right.
Plain and simple, right? And if you don't know that, there's a weed bed here, I got to look for dragonflies are around weed beds. They like hanging out underwater with vegetation, and they're ambush hunters, that kind of stuff. If you don't know the basic knowledge of the bug, not so much their life cycle. Their life cycle is obviously you need to know that too, but just their movements, how they live, how they hunt, how they hide. That's a very important part, and a lot of people don't know that.
And we're still contending with bugs that have sometimes very short lifespans or very long lifespans, right?
Exactly. There's some that have extremely short, from a couple of months up to, 3 to 4 years for a dragonfly, as an example.
Yeah.
Right? So.
Now, Frank Wood from Norwalk, California, asks, how much can be learned about stillwater entomology by observing bankside vegetation? You just kind of referenced that, but...
Basically, everything.
Everything. Okay. That's
the first thing I do when I go to a lake that I've never been to. Let's just say I'm coming out to Idaho and I'm going to go fishing in Idaho to a lake. I've never fished this lake. I will get there preferably going in the evening, getting my flashlight out, getting to that shoreline. Let's see what's moving. Shine that flashlight into there. Bugs get attracted by the light. Let's see what's moving. Let's see how they move. Let's see the colors. Let's see the sizes. And then in the morning, again, I will try to look down close to shore, get into the, if there's any reeds sticking out, take a look. Is there shucks or casings of dragons or damsels or caddis or whatever floating around or hanging off of them? So you can learn a lot about what is in a certain body of water just by looking on shore.
Well, now, I know, and I'm going to jump way down our questions, but there was a question about going up to a lake that had little or no vegetation. What do you do then?
It's the same thing. It's the same thing. Now, I'm going to use an example up here in British Columbia. There's a private lake on a Highland Valley copper mine that's an old tailings pond. that they filled with water, and they stocked it with trout and so on and so forth. Now, it's crystal clear. There's barely any vegetation, if any. They're starting to bring vegetation in, actually, but there's nothing in there. So what do? You gotta be able to find out. What do you do in a river? You flip rocks over. You start looking on in the mud, close to shore. That same thing. It's not quite as easy as it is with when you've got bulrush or charweed or something like that to look at, but it's the same process, you know. So you just take a look there. You take a look in the pieces of wood, debris, dead leaves, anything.
Yeah, because it's just not as easy as many of us are used to on streams, you know, to get out there with a net and throw some, you know, turn over some rocks and seine, because, you know, we're facing depth of water and so forth that we can't necessarily get into the lake as easily as a stream.
Oh, definitely. It is more difficult. You have to be a lot more aware of your surroundings while you're out there fishing. I am constantly looking, seeing what's flying around, seeing what kind of casings are floating on the water. Bird action, big time. If you see bird action, you know there's something hatching. Go there. You know, so it does take a little bit more effort to really pay attention to what's going on, but it's the same concept as in a river.
Okay. Joe from Marcy, New York asks, are there differences between lakes in the east and lakes in the west? And I noticed we just got a question in on the internet from Ken Calhoun, who lives down in Texas, and he talks about fishing mostly for bream or bass down there, bream or bass. And, you know, what insects are there? Are there common insects throughout the north and the south?
There is. You do have common insects throughout North America, actually throughout the world. Now, your subspecies are going to change from one location to another. Down in the south compared to the north, there's going to be a different subspecies of dragonfly, but it's still going to be a dragonfly.
Right.
They generally have the same life cycles, the same behaviors, generally, but not always. So wherever your area happens to be is a really good point, and there's actually a question later on that I noticed that I can kind of answer here, and that is, if you've got an area, let's just say Halifax in Canada here, and you don't know what's hatching, what to look for, go to your local or phone your local university. If you can't find stuff from a fly fishing shop or anything like that you're satisfied with, go to your local university or call them and talk to somebody in the aquatic entomology department. Most major universities have them, and they're more than willing to share their information. So, you know, from locale to locale, it is different, but it's not. You know what I'm saying?
Right. Yeah, and I think, you know, reading through your book and looking at all the, you know, insects that you had in there, well, we have those all down here in the Rocky Mountains. I know many of those are in the Midwest and the lakes there as well. So a lot of what we talk about tonight should apply, like you say, just different species and variations, but the principles are the same.
Basically it is the same. Like, it can get quite confusing. You know, when there's certain species out there, mayflies are one. There's 1,500 subspecies of mayfly in North America.
Right.
I've been doing this for 17, 18 years full time, and I mean, I've been fishing since I was 3 years old, and there's no chance in heck that I'm going to know all 1,500 subspecies. I don't want to know all 1,500.
Right.
I want to know the ones the fish are targeting.
Yeah.
You know? So
we've got Shane in Alaska who was asking about entomology for Alaskan still waters, and as you just mentioned, Mark Power's question about, you know, Halifax, Nova Scotia. So, and then Ken down in Texas, just go, like you said, to the local university if you can't get the proper information and do your research. Kevin Kritzner in Wilson, Wyoming wants to know, could you give us a list of tools that you would suggest a person have to do their homework on any body of water?
Well, I always do my homework before I leave, always. You know, and I can, obviously, if I'm going to a lake that I know, well, that I don't need to because I've fished it many a times. But again, let's use the Idaho as an example. I'm heading down to Idaho. I do all the research I can. I phone the local fly shops. I talk to guides if I can. I go on the internet and I do research on that lake and find out what's the depth like. What's the water color? Is it a tea stained lake? Is it a crystal clear lake? Is it an algae lake? Is it, you know, what's the elevation of it? What's the, you know, location. Is it in a deserty setting? Is it in a bush setting? You know what I mean? There's so many different things you can find out, and then you can figure out what kind of insects you're going to be targeting. I know, as an example, a lot of people use grasshoppers as an example in rivers. Well, grasshoppers are a very effective insect to use in lakes as well, depending on the area. If you're in an area where there's a lot of grasshoppers on shore, they fall off the weeds, they fall off the grass on the banks, and they fall into the water. The fish feed on them.
Right.
So it's the same thing. You got to do your research, right? So that's the tools that you need, is to figure out what is there, where you're going. What kind of water is it?
Yeah, I think maybe Kevin was talking more specifically about, and I'm just guessing here from his question, but maybe he's talking about things like, you know, an insect
a throat pump and that kind of stuff?
That, and or collection, you know, if you want to collect these insects.
Well, you can. I'll go with, I've got a little aquarium net that I take with me. It's always in my pack or on my boat, always. I always have a little aquarium net because, you know, I'm sitting there chronomid fishing or whatever, and, you know, there's something floating by. Hey, what's that? Dip in, take a look. Oh, okay, hey, it's got some red rib in it, and, you know, take a look at it. So that's one. Throat pump is another one that is extremely valuable to a fly fisher in the lakes, but be very, very careful with them. There's a lot of people that don't know how to properly use them, and you're just doing more damage to the fish than good, right? So
give us a tip on how to use one.
Well, a lot of people, what they seem to want to do is, first of all, they'll put it down the throat too far. I've seen some people putting a throat pump into a fish that's like 10 inches long. I never, ever pump a fish that's under 12.
Because the tail's probably bigger than their entry point into the front.
Well, yeah, but you see some people trying to shove it down there, right? If there's any sort of resistance, stop. Just stop. It could be stressed out. The throats could have closed. It could be too small. Just stop. You're going to hurt it. And the other most important thing, and this is the biggest error I see in a lot of people, is they will fill that bulb up with water and then shove it down the throat, and then they'll pump the water into the fish and suck it back out. It's the wrong thing to do. It's not right. You have that pump empty, depress the bulb, put it into the mouth of the fish, down the throat, let go of the bulb, pull it out, and it'll automatically suck. It'll be a dry suck, and it'll suck anything out that it just ate that's in its throat, not in its stomach. I don't care what's in its stomach. It could have ate that 4 hours ago. I want to know what it ate in the last 15 minutes.
There you go. That's very good information. Very good.
Right? So, yeah. And then you put that into a glass vial, take a look at it, and whatever's alive is the last thing he ate, more than likely.
Yeah.
So.
Good. Very good tip. Very good tip. We've got a question here, and I kind of put this in here. Let me reverse the questions as we've got them on our list here, but because then we'll lead into talking about specific bugs. But Kent in Southern California raised an interesting question about planted hatchery fish. You know, and I suppose this applies to lakes or streams. You know, when do they convert over from eating pellets to natural food sources? Do they do that naturally, you know, immediately?
Yeah.
Or?
You know, it's kind of a funny question that's happened to come up. I was just speaking to Todd Oishi. He's the captain of Team Canada here for the World Fly Fishing Championships. I was just speaking to him this afternoon, actually, about his he was competing in Quebec last year in the Nationals. And the lake that they were fishing, nobody in the first 2 days caught anything. Nobody. I mean, there was, I think, six fish caught in 2 days between 60 competitors. And these are the best in the world. And then he found out the last day the fish were being caught left, right, and center. And they found out that the day before the competition started, they stocked the lake. So within the first 2 days, they were still in shock. They didn't want to eat. The third day, they started eating. So that's a pretty good answer right there.
Yeah, it takes them a while to get acclimated and get hungry, I guess.
Yeah, it takes them a couple of days. Two to 3 days is fairly normal. You'll get the odd one right away. Like if fish has been stocked last night, you'll get the odd one today.
Yeah.
But I usually, if there's a stocking program and I want to go and fish that lake just for fun or take my kid or something like that, I'll wait a few days. Let them get acclimatized to the temperature change, the acidity in the water, the nutrient levels. There's so many different things that they have to get used to.
Right.
Let it get acclimatized. Go after them in 2 to 3 days.
Right. The other question is, person, and this is anonymous here, so I don't know who wrote the question, but it says, one of the lakes I fish has a lot of small green nymphs, and the fish are often full of them. I can't tell whether they're mayflies or damsels. Is there an easy way to know for sure? I suppose they could be caddis, too.
They could be. Actually, the easiest way to tell the difference between a caddis, they're actually pretty easy to identify. I mean, they got the long legs trailing behind them usually if they're out of their casing, because a lot of times they're in a protective casing, whether it's mud or rocks or sticks or something like that, right? So they're fairly easy to identify. The difference between a may and a damsel, often it's size. Mays are going to be a lot smaller. That's one. But a real telltale way to look at the tail. If you've got two or three, like, usually you got the mayfly, it's got the three little skinny tails. That's fairly common, the three tails coming out the back end. A damselfly will have pretty well the same thing, but it'll have a whole bunch of hairs on it. They look like little paddles. And they actually use those for swimming, and that's their gills.
Okay.
On a damselfly. So it's pretty simple. If to tell the difference between a damsel and a mayfly, just take a look at the tail. If it's got those little paddle-like gills on the back, it's a damsel.
Yeah, I'm looking in your book right now. That's very, very apparent. I mean, the
yeah, it is.
I mean, there's no question about which one you're looking at when you actually look at a picture of it. The other thing is to get a book to look
yeah.
at, it, right? And, like yours, and plug your book here that Rick just wrote. Just, in fact, it's hot off the press, but my copy is literally still smoking, I think. But this is his insect guide to lakes of Western Canada and the Pacific Northwest, but I'm sure it applies to, like we said, just about any still water.
But, it does.
While you were talking, I was looking at the two pictures here. Very, very clear as to what you're looking at there. So.
Yeah, it, like I said, it is. Once you see a picture of the two, there's no mistaking what it is. A lot of people actually make a mistake and misidentify mayfly nymphs because they can be pretty small with scuds, you know. So read books. Whether it's my book or somebody else's book,
right,
and there's tons
right,
of good
right.
entomology books out there.
Exactly.
Read books. I mean, that's how I learned, you know, reading books, taking classes.
Exactly. Pete Gramp in Pennsylvania asks, he's read and heard a bunch of different sources that say 90% of the fish's diet is below the surface, yet the fly shops he frequents often sell dry flies almost twice as often as others. Could you comment on this seeming contradiction?
That's fairly easy to answer. A river runs through it.
Okay.
It's you know what? A lot of fly fishermen get into fishing because that strike, that action, that top water, bang, right? That's what really sucks a lot of fly fishers in. And it is. It's an amazing rush to have that, see that fly get sucked down that mouth. But the majority of it is true. 90% of the feeding takes place subsurface, in rivers and in lakes. That's period. There's no ands, ifs, no buts. That's where it all happens. But a lot of fly fishers want that rush of seeing it, so, you know, the fly shops and others, you know, seem to focus on that because that's what, plain and simple, and I'm not affiliated with any fly shop anywhere, but if I was a fly shop, and that's where I could make my money selling dries, well, I'm going to sell dries.
Sure.
Right? So.
Exactly. It's just marketing, yeah.
Yeah, it is. So, but it's the glorification of seeing that strike and that excitement and that adrenaline rush that you see when that big splash behind your line, right? So.
Sure. We all love that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Pete also has another, he says, okay, I'll be the guy who asks, what are the first fly patterns you reach for when fishing still waters?
Again, it all depends. It depends on the lake. It depends on what I found on shore, right? Because that's the first thing I do is I'll do my research before I get there, and then when I get to shore, I'll take a look at what's abundant. But if I didn't have a chance, let's just say I didn't have a chance to do that, my first thing is a leech. It's a nice big, buggy, mouthful pattern that fish just seem to love. So that's my first. Usually my first if I haven't done any of that research, but normally I'll do my research, and if I see that there's a lot of dragonfly husks or shells, casings, whatever you want to call them, sitting on shore near weeds and stuff like that, then I know that there's a healthy population of dragonflies. That's the first thing I'll go for.
Uh-huh. So with your research that you've talked about, you've got a pretty good idea what's supposed to be there. I mean, you have expectations. For instance, if it's April, there probably, and depending on where you are, there might not be any dragonflies for another 2 months or something.
Exactly. So you do have an I have an idea when I go, but again, here we go with the whole thing, and this is going to repeat a lot throughout this show. I know this. Elevation, weather pattern, temperatures, barometric pressure, all that matters. I mean, last year here, Roche Lake, which is one of the most famous lakes around, Roche Lake was at the latest ice off since 1976. It didn't ice free until June 6th, right? That threw everything off all year long. It just, I mean, the hatches were just a mess last year. So
everybody's confused.
We were all of the guys that I know were like, okay, what's going to happen? Is everything going to be 2 weeks late? Or is it going to be mass hatches happening? And what we found last year is there was hatches happening over top of hatches that weren't supposed to be crossing over each other, you know?
So
it was a really strange year last year. So weather pattern, elevation, all that stuff makes a difference. It does make a difference. So, like I said, I'll do my research. If I know the weather has been unseasonably cool and we're at an elevation of 5,000 feet where this lake is and so on and so forth, I'll have a rough idea. Okay, well, it's been unseasonably cool. It iced off late. More than likely, dragons are going to be 2 weeks later than they normally are. So what's before dragons? Okay, that's before dragon. Bang, that's what I'll put on.
We've got a couple of questions here, one from Jack in Louisiana and one, again, from Ken in Texas. Both are kind of asking the same thing and want to know, how closely do flies have to mimic various bugs? Do you have to match the hatch like you do on a river or stream?
To a point. Yeah, you can't just throw anything out there. You do have to match the hatch to a certain degree. With certain bugs, it's a lot more important. Chironomids, as an example, and I guess we'll get into the chironomids later on because that's a pretty big subject for stillwaters. But with chironomids, yeah, you need to be pretty close. I mean, you got to have that ribbing of the right color and the right size, and I mean, it doesn't matter how many ribs there are because fish can't count. But you have to be fairly close. Others can be more of an attractor style pattern. I use a lot of attractor styles myself.
I was going to say, like damsels, is that something that is more of a living thing than a attractor kind of pattern?
Kind of. It's more of the patterns I tie up for my damsels. I use a lot of marabou for the tail to mimic those paddles that they have in the back moving around. I'll put some dumbbell eyes on, or I'll put Burt Mono eyes on it. Give it three or four pieces of pheasant tail out each side behind the head there to mimic legs. So it's close to the original, like to the natural, but it's not as important as it is in the rivers. I mean, the rivers you're really trying to be fussy with color and size, and so it's not quite as fussy.
Ryan in Kelowna.
Kelowna.
D.C., up north of you there. He's wondering what the seasonal order of the insects are, and is there one, or is that, like you said, he talks about water temperature, air temperature, and so forth, but is there kind of a seasonal order that is pretty predictable with the insects coming off?
Yeah, there pretty well is. You can't go by the exact dates or anything like that. Again, here we go again, temperatures, weather patterns, so on and so forth, but... Yeah, I actually have a hatch chart up for this area up on my website. It's a little bad right now, but I'm actually putting a new one up tomorrow, a downloadable PDF file. So, but yeah, there is. There, like damselflies as an example, the most prolific activity for damsels is June and July. Dragons, June, July, into August. Mayflies, they start in May and go through July. Scuds, again, the scuds are always around. They're always in the water. So are dragons and damsels. They're always there. The nymphs are always there. But activity-wise, hatch-wise, movement, massive migrations happen at certain times. And there is charts out there. Like I said, I have one on my site. Jim Scholmeyer actually came out with a really, really good one a while ago. He does one for Stillwaters and for Rivers. So, I mean, they're out there. There definitely is a pattern. But again, weather does play a big part of that. You know, there is times when there should be dragons happening here. Why aren't they happening? Last year was a prime example. Right?
Yeah,
so,
exactly. Yeah, yeah.
You know.
And I think I know what you're going to say on this one, but Jordan in Richmond, B.C. wants to know, does any one type of insect know when it's the right time? How does an insect know what the right time to hatch is? Similarly, why does one kind of chironomid hatch at a totally different time than another?
Well, first of all, it's instinctual. They know. It's just like, how does a salmon know that that's where it was born, right? It's an instinctual thing. But when it comes to why do they hatch at different times, well, when were they laid, right? There is a time when they were laid. The egg was laid at a certain time, takes a certain amount of time to become the adult, to become, you know, go through the stages, go through the instars, get ready to be, you know, to hatch. So, you know, if one was laid in June, well, it's going to hatch at a certain time. If another one was hatched in July, was laid in July, it's going to be obviously, it's going to hatch at a later time. And water temperature, weather, blah, 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 all plays part of that too. Right? Nutrition levels in the water too.
Right, right. So. All those things. Well, we need to take a quick break here, but when we come back, we're going to jump into some of those specific bugs, and we'll start out with chironomids and have you dig deep into each one of these and tell us what you know. Okay, Rick?
Sounds great.
Keeney's Fly Shop in Sacramento, California features classes on all aspects of fly fishing. Keeney's Fly Shop has an extensive inventory and fly tying department and a friendly, experienced staff whose primary goal is your complete satisfaction. Among their many services, one can book private waters or take advantage of their international travel service. Visit their extensive website at www.keeney.com, that's K-I-E-N-E.com, or call them at 1-800-400-0359. Again, that's 1-800-400-0359. We're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Rick Pasek about entomology for still waters. If you'd like to ask Rick a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Well, before we go on, Rick, and get into the chironomids, I just want you to take a few minutes and tell us about, you know, what's happening with you in the fly fishing world and a bit about your business and your latest endeavors and achievements.
Okay. Right now, like you said, it's hot off the presses. My latest book, it just came out so 3.5 weeks ago. My first book, The Freshman Fly Fisher, it's a beginner's guide that goes through everything, you know, rods, reels, lines, flies, all that kind of stuff. That came out last year, and the insect guide is just a nice little pocket, you have it in your hands there. Nice little pocket guide. I purposely designed it so it could go into a fly vest, and it's got a nice waterproof cover and the whole nine yards. So, but right now it's just, yeah, that's what I'm doing. I'm actually just started writing my third book a couple days ago and getting on to that. I'm hoping to have, my plan is 10 books in 10 years, less time, so. Like you said off the beginning, I'm a member of Trouts Unlimited Canada, Trouts Unlimited USA, Federation of Fly Fishers, Federation of Fly Fishers BC, Thor Writers Group. I'm on the pro staff with Howard Hackle, Norvice, and Froghair. So that's right now what I'm doing a lot of is trying to volunteer a lot, helping out at the Becoming an Outdoors Woman, teaching women how to fly fish and how to camp and the whole nine yards. I'm trying to volunteer with Casting for Recovery as well, helping them ladies out. So that's what I'm doing. I do a lot of teaching, a lot of seminars, go around talking at the various trade shows. So if anybody's interested in, you know, I've got a blog on the internet there and date it usually every second day, sometimes every day. Lately it's been a little tough to do that because of the book and stuff, but they're more than happy I'd be happy if they go there. There's tons of information. I do fly tying and all kinds of stuff. So, and that's www.flyfishfanatic.com, the Fly Fish Fanatic. sorry. It's at theflyfishfanatic.com. And then my website is www.rp3flyfishing.com, and I do classes and weekend classes and stuff like that on the water, do entomology, the whole nine yards. So,
great.
And the last thing that I'm into right now is I just formed a team for the Canadian National Fly Fishing Championships that's going to be held here in Fernie, B.C. in September, and just getting ready for that.
You better be practicing, huh?
Oh, I've got about 4 weeks' worth of practice time all set already for the summer.
Oh, really? Oh, good.
Oh, yeah.
Good. Well, let's dig into the bugs here. Let's talk about chironomids first. We've got a couple of questions here, but why don't you, I noticed Jim in Indiana asked, how long does it take for a chironomid to go from an egg to an adult? You know, what's the difference between a chironomid and a bloodworm? Les in Washington wants to know. Why don't you give us a little background about the chironomid, what we should know and how we should fish it?
Okay, well, the chironomid actually starts off as an egg, like they all do, starts off as an egg, then it becomes the larva. The larva is what most people know as the bloodworm. Okay, the bloodworm actually lives in the substrate, in the mud, in the rotten debris, whatever. That's where they live. They feed down there. Most of them, not all of them, are filter feeders. Some of them are actually hunters. They will eat other insects. They will live in that form. It all depends, again, on subspecies, nutrient levels in the lakes, elevation. Sometimes they can live for up to a year. So, last year they'll be laid, say, in September. This year they will be coming out as a larva. Then when they're ready to become the adult, what they will do is they will seal themselves into a little cocoon. They'll transform into the pupal stage. The pupal stage, now that's the stage that we mostly fish. We do fish the bloodworm stage, but we mostly fish the pupal stage. They will break open that cocoon and they head straight up the water column. They want to get out of the water, up, straight up. They don't fool around, they just try to get up. Now, most chironomids, very slow movers. Some of them are quite fast. I mean, I've seen some, you know, moving 15 feet in a couple of minutes. Others I've seen take an hour to go that far. So then they straight up the water column. They fight to get through that surface slime or that tension, the water tension, and their backs break open. Out comes the adult. Off they go. Start the cycle all over again. And that's the basics of the chironomid. Obviously, there's a lot more to it, but that's the basics of a chironomid.
And then what time of year are they doing this?
Well, the pupal stage, you can start getting them, well, up here right now because it's fairly mild. We got, you know, what is that in Fahrenheit? 6 degrees Celsius. So, I don't know, low 50s. We're starting to have hatches here. Now, up in the interior where the lakes are still frozen, well, obviously they're still in their larval stage. They're hidden under the substrate. It's not as much of a target for the fish, but they're still available. They do feed on them still during the winter. But the most prolific time for chironomids, for hatching, for becoming the pupal and then going through their rise to the surface and to become an adult is usually late April through October, right through the year. And you'll constantly have chironomid hatches happening. And this is one thing that a lot of the guys out there, and there might be actually some questions about this, I'm not sure, but one thing that a lot of guys got to remember when tying their chironomids or buying chironomids, try to find some that have a little bit of sparkle and a little bit of shine or sheen. Because chironomids, what they'll do is once they're ready to come up, I mean, it's a lot of work for this little insect to get up 20 feet of water. What they do is they'll actually take on gases. They'll fill their body basically with gases under their skin to help them rise. And as they rise through the water column, there's obviously less and less and less gases. Right? So if you're fishing deep, you want something that's got a lot of shine, a lot of silvers and golds and sheen in it. That's the chromie. Because they have those gases trapped. As they get up the water column, that slowly goes away and you start getting more of the colors, the browns, the greens, the blacks, you know. So.
Well, we did have a question from Justin in Vancouver. He's asking, is there a certain amount of ribs that's proper for a chironomid? Does that make any difference when you're tying them?
Well, like I said earlier, they can't really count, can they? And if they can't count, I'm in trouble, and so is everybody else. But average for me, I usually do somewhere between 5 and 7 wraps of a rib. But again, that depends on the size of the chronomid. If I'm tying a size 16, I'm going to probably go, you know, somewhere around 4 or 5 ribs. Size 12, I'll probably go 5 to 7 ribs. So it does depend. And you know, like I said, as long as you've got that nice segmentation, you've got the ribs in it, that's more important than how many.
Okay.
You know.
Brian from Kamloops wants to know, is there one chronomid pattern for Stillwater Rainbow what would it be, color, hook size, etc.?
Well, there's actually two, but if I had to pick one, I would have to go with a black chronomid with a white bead head and red ribbing. That's probably my most prolific chronomid. I mean, I've caught more fish on that color pattern than anything.
That kind of like in your book, the red butt snow cone?
That's the one. That's exactly the one, the red butt snow cone. You know, a little bit of a red butt on it, then a red rib, black body with a white snow cone head. You can use Antron for the gills if you want. You don't have to. But that's probably my number one most successful fly.
What's two then? We got to know what two is since you said there were two.
Two is the Chromie. I mean, the Chromie is such an excellent pattern, especially because most of the time when you're fishing chronomids, let's say you're using a floating line with a strike indicator, you're in 16 feet of water, you're going to set your indicator up for 15 feet, and that's where you're going to start fishing is a foot from the bottom. Well, a foot from the bottom, they got a lot of gases trapped. There you go. There's the Chromie pattern.
Okay.
So the Chromie pattern is just there's one that's really popular up here. I don't know how popular it is down in the U.S., but it's an anti-static bag chronomid. And what that is the anti-static bags that you get for computers. Like when you got a motherboard and stuff like that, and you get it delivered, it's in an anti-static bag, a gray bag. We take that, we slice that up into about 1/8 wide strips, tie that as the body, then use a red or silver rib around it. Done. It's finished, and it's got a beautiful holographic kind of sheen to it. They're awesome.
What do you use for a head on it?
That depends on what you're tying. Usually, I'll go with that. I'll put white Antron gills out the front. And then I'll use a gunmetal tungsten gunmetal bead.
Okay.
Usually.
Good. Yeah. Well, you started to give some tips on how to fish this, and we do have a question from Nicholas Gates in Salt Spring Island. He says when he fishes chronomids regularly with a strike indicator and up to 20 feet of leader tippet, he said if there's no wind and it's sunny, fishing is very slow. I usually use beadhead chronomid patterns with various shiny mylar bodies, just what you were talking about. Would it benefit me to change to a blander color body material and dump the bead using a white nylon for gills? I'm thinking the blander, more exact imitation might fool the fish.
Like I just explained, if you realize what the life cycle of the chronomid is and that the fact that they use those gases to raise themselves to that water column, It's pretty self-explanatory. Down low, you want shiny, you want bright. Well, not really shiny, but you want brighter. You want to imitate those gases being trapped. As you come up the water column, you want to go lighter. You want to get, not so much lighter, you want to get rid of that shine. That's when you start getting into your greens, your browns, your blacks, that kind of stuff.
Or the blander colors he's talking about. So part of that is finding out where in the water column, I guess, the fish are as well, right?
Exactly. Chronomid fishing can be hair-pulling. Well, I'm bald, so, I mean, there's a reason.
You've already pulled it all out, right?
All of it. So chronomid fishing can be extremely tough, extremely tedious work. I mean, it can be. Once you've found the depth, the size, and the color, you can have 100 fish day. I mean, I've had many 100 fish days doing that. Once you found it. I've had days where I go and, I mean, I know I've got the right color because I've done a throat pump. I know I've got the right size. I can't figure out the depth. Where are they? Are they at 18 feet and 20 feet of water? Are they at 16 feet, 17 feet, 12 feet? Where are they? You know, because they'll like fish, they like hanging around a certain depth because they know there's a lot there. So they do that. So figuring out depth, I would say, in my opinion, depth is the most important. If you figure out the depth, even if you're off by one size, you're still going to catch fish. But you've got to be in the zone where the fish are. That's the most important thing.
Any tips on how to figure that out? Other than switching up?
It's trial and error. Yeah, honestly, it is. The majority of the time, it's trial and error. Again, knowledge, though. If you're fishing a red pattern, a bloodworm-style pattern, you want to be as close to the bottom as you can. If you're fishing a silvery pattern, you want to be within the first, you know, depending on the depth that you're fishing in, but the first 20% of the water, like the lowest part, the lowest 20%, the deepest 20%. And then as you've got different colors, you move up. But a lot of it's trial and error. I almost always start near the bottom, and then I'll do one cast, do my figure eight retrieve, do my second cast, do my figure eight retrieve, nothing, I'll move up 2 feet. Do that again, nothing, move up 2 feet. Still nothing, change my fly, go back down to the bottom.
Okay, so now what's your figure eight retrieve? You mean with your fingers?
Well, yeah, it's just a really, really slow, you're kind of wrapping the fly line around your fingers in a figure eight. It's a really dead slow retrieve. I mean, I always say this in my classes and my seminars and everything. If you think you're retrieving slow enough, you're not. Slow down.
And you've got a strike indicator out there as well?
Yes. Okay. Now, I don't always fish with a strike indicator. I do fish naked, too, without a strike indicator. But for anybody that's starting off with carotomids, I highly recommend a strike indicator. It's very hard to see because they're extremely subtle takes. I mean, sometimes that indicator can just, like if there's a little bit of wind and it's moving a little bit and it just does something different. It doesn't do the right movement. That's a strike. It moves sideways a quarter of an inch. That's a strike. I mean, the carotomids aren't going anywhere, so the fish don't have to hurry. They're just kind of opening their mouths and swimming around eating them, right?
So are you trying to move, if I was looking sideways at the water column, and I'm seeing you retrieve this, are you trying to retrieve the carotomid parallel in that water column, in other words, parallel at that depth level to the, let's say 2 feet off the bottom? So you're going really slow so it stays at the same depth, but it's coming closer and closer to you.
Exactly. Now, every once in a while, what I'll do just to try to gain a bit of interest, especially if I'm using a chromie-style pattern where there's lots of shine there, I'll do the figure eight retrieve. I'll do that for, say, a minute. Then I'll stop, let it sit. Then I'll give it a little twitch, a couple of little quick, sharp little two-inch twitches just to get that fly moving in there a little bit. And that quite often will entice a strike. If not, okay, fine, back to my little figure eight.
Okay.
So.
Okay, need to take a quick break here, but when we come back, we'll talk with Rick more about entomology for still waters. Women's fly fishing in Alaska is owned and operated by well-known female guide Pudge Kleinkopf. Women's fly fishing offers several lodge-based fly fishing schools for women, as well as an array of small group guided trips for women and couples to some of Alaska's best-known waters for salmon, rainbow trout, Arctic grayling, and char. Pudge also leads saltwater fly fishing groups to Mexico each spring. Beginners are welcome and equipment is provided. Learn more about fly fishing for women at www.womensflyfishing.net or call them at 907-274-7113, 907-274-1113. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Rick Pasek and about entomology for still waters. If you'd like to ask Rick a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com. Use that Q&A text box there to send us your question. We'll receive it immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as we can on the show tonight. Okay, Rick, anything else that you wanted to say about carotomids before we move on to caddis here?
The only thing I can say to anybody that's, especially the guys that are starting out with fly fishing and doing carotomids, is be patient, because it can be extremely rewarding. It does take time. This is probably the most difficult insect to learn in still waters is carotomids. But once you've learned it, I mean, I know guys up here that are phenomenal fly fishers, and that's all they use. They don't use anything else but carotomids.
Wow.
So,
Treg, and this is a question off the Internet. Treg from Moscow, Idaho, wants to know, how do you get your strike indicator to release?
It depends on the strike indicators you're using. I use ones that are designed by, and a lot of you guys probably know him, I think he was on your show, Phil Rowley.
Yeah, yes.
Yeah. He's got one, I'm not sure if it's through Stillwater Solutions, his company, or the company they used to have, or not, but it's a quick release indicator. So the line goes through a plastic straw, let's say it's called. It's not a straw, but it's like a plastic tube with a hole in it. Goes through that, then goes through your indicator. You take that straw thing out, you kind of create a little loop, and then you pinch that loop into the indicator. Okay, but you don't pinch it too hard, just lightly. Chuck that out. As soon as you've got a hit, all you do is lift your rod to set the hook, and doop, that thing pops off. And now it'll be riding down by the fish's nose.
Huh.
Right? So it's called the quick release strike indicator, and that's the only ones I use nowadays. I don't use the pinch-ons, I don't use yarn, I don't use any of that stuff.
And for the folks that haven't done any chronometer fishing, why do you need that to release like that? Why is that useful?
Well, if you're fishing in 20 feet of water and you've got your indicator set at 18 feet, you've only got a 9-foot rod, how are you going to get that fish into your net? That's why. It's really simple. It's pretty tough to get a fish into your net when you've got 19 feet of line out there and you can't get it into you can't get the indicator into your guides.
Right, right.
Right. So, and okay. You don't want to be touching your line.
Let's talk about caddis then for a bit. We do have a question from Jim Drury in Vancouver. Can you explain, the life cycle of the caddis and how it moves through the water? And I'm sure that was one of the things you're going to cover. But why don't you give us just a bit a background about caddis?
Well, again, caddis are actually quite an intriguing one. There's 1,200 and something subspecies in North America, and there's so many different ones that I'm not going to get into any specifics of subspecies and all that kind of stuff. But typically, they're case builders. So they will use their saliva, and they will build themselves cocoons. They'll build themselves stuff to protect their bodies. Usually their little heads and their front legs are sticking out so they can move around, but their bodies are extremely soft and vulnerable. So they'll use rocks, they'll use sticks, they'll use leaves, they'll use whatever they can to make this cocoon, and it moves around with them. When they're ready to, when they're finish their final instar or their final molt to become the next stage, they will completely encase themselves in that cocoon, if you want to call it that. It's a simple way to put it. And they will go from there to the next stage. Once they're in that stage, they will go straight up the water column. Now they're in the pupal stage now. They'll go straight up the water column, out of the water. They want out. So just like most bugs, they go out. They want out of the water. They break open. They hatch. They become the adult. On still waters, especially in the Pacific Northwest here, I'm not too sure about the rest of the country, but I'm assuming by how every video I've ever seen and anything I've ever read, most caddisflies or sedges are the same. They need to dry their wings off. They need to get blood into those wings. They need to dry them off. So they'll kind of skitter across the surface, and you get that telltale V that they create, like a little wake. And that's typical. And, the trout just love that. So that's one instance where dry fly fishing is phenomenal in the lakes, is when the caddis hatch is happening. So that's basically the life cycle, real quick thing of the life cycle of a caddis. It spends most of its life is in the case stage, in the larval stage. Once they become a pupa, they just out. Within one day, they're out.
What about when they're laying their eggs? How do they act when they're laying eggs?
Well, a lot of bugs do the same thing, actually. Caddis, they can. There's a few different ways they do it, again, depending on subspecies. But some of them will fly over the water and dip their abdomens in, but the majority of them, what they'll do is they'll actually crawl right into the water at shore. Or they'll lay their eggs just subsurface on weed beds, and like weeds, chara weeds, bulrush, anything like that that's sticking out, they'll lay them just subsurface. So a lot of bugs actually do that. Mayflies do the same thing. Mayflies actually will swim right underwater as an adult. They'll go right down. But mayflies, damsels will do the same thing, dragons, so.
Well, I noticed on a number of evenings on this little lake up at my father's place that, the caddis seem to be flying over the lake and going down and doing the dipping routine.
Yeah.
And when that's happening, what's the best approach from a technique, a strategy to get them on the fly?
In all honesty, there's not much. I mean, they spend so little time on the water doing that. I mean, they're down dip. There's really not an opportunity for the trout to get them at that point. When the trout do target them is when they hatch. Right when they hatch, they're at the adult stage, starting to dry their wings, get the blood going to them, and they're taxiing for takeoff, if you want to call it that.
Right.
That's the main stage that for the dry fly fisher that you're gonna target. The dipping and the hatching. In all honesty, I've never seen a fish take a caddis when it's coming in to lay its eggs, ever.
Yeah, I mean, the night I was there and struggling, I actually caught a really nice fish, but I caught him on a caddis pupa, you know, subsurface.
Yep.
So, you know, yeah. But that was probably more luck than strategy there.
Well, just because you see the adults coming and dipping and doing their egg laying doesn't mean there's others not hatching. So there could be others, another wave coming, hatching, and, well, like you said earlier, 90% of the feeding takes place subsurface, so if you're using a nymph during a hatch, that's, you know.
So what's your, if you've got a hatch coming off, what's your strategy there? I mean, do you fish a two-fly rig? Do you fish a dry and a dropper off of that subsurface? What's your approach?
Well, in all honesty, up here in British Columbia, we're only allowed to use one fly.
We're
single barbless. But the few places I have fished where, like in Alberta, down in Idaho, Montana, places like that, Washington, where you're allowed a dropper, absolutely. Why not? Put a Michelux Edge or something like that as a dry on top and throw an emerging pupa on the bottom. Why not? I mean, it, depending on the time of the hatch, if you can just see, okay, there's one there, 5 minutes later, oh, there's one there, oh, there's one, there's another one, and it starts picking up, you know the hatch is starting, that's when I fish an emerging pupa just subsurface. I'll use a dry line, and I'll use a emerging pupa with a little bit of an orange butt that kind of signifies that it's starting to peel open or start the hatch process. Right, it's got a little orange butt on it, little immature wing bud casings on the right behind the head, little legs sticking out, whether they're little rubber silly legs or whether they're pheasant tail fibers, whatever. So I'll fish that off a dry line just subsurface at the beginning of a hatch. But once the hatch starts going and you see the rises and the takes, I mean, I put that away, dry line, Michelux Edge, out I go.
Okay. So. Now, you just mentioned dry line there. When you were going back to Chronomids, are you fishing floating dry line there as well, I assume, right?
Well, both, actually. I fish a floating dry with the indicator. I'll do a floating dry with naked. But I also, in deeper waters, anything over 20 feet, I'll usually go with a sinking line. And then I'll do a really slow retrieve with a sinking line.
A sinking, not the intermediate sinking?
No, I say like a type 3.
Okay.
Right, a type 3 sink. Depending, again, it depends on the depth, because your type 3 is only going to sink, I think it's 1.25 to 1.75 inches per second, and it'll only make a maximum depth. It'll never go 50 feet. It just won't. That's just the way it is. There's buoyancy involved, right? So if I'm in a 40 feet, well, I'm going to throw on a type 6 sink and do the same thing.
Yeah.
Right?
Okay.
So.
Okay, let's take a break here real quick, and then we'll come back and we'll talk about dragons and damsels here next. So, Royal Gorge Anglers is a full-service fly shop on the Arkansas River in Canyon City, Colorado. They also provide both walk, wade, and float fishing guide service on the Arkansas, South Platte, and several private high country ranches. They specialize in fly fishing education and work to assure that everyone taking a trip leaves being a better fly fisher. For the best service and the most fun in the Southern Rockies, visit the folks at Royal Gorge Anglers, the gateway to Southern Colorado. Located conveniently on U.S. 50, only 45 minutes from Colorado Springs. For more information, visit their website at www.royalgorgeanglers.com. That's royalgorgeanglers.com. Or call them at 888-994-6743. That's 888-994-6743. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Rick Pasek about entomology for still waters. If you'd like to ask Rick a question, just go to our homepage, fill out that little form there in the text box, send us your question, we'll try to answer it on the show tonight. Okay, let's talk about dragons and damsels.
My favorite subject.
It is, okay.
Oh, yeah. Now, just one quick thing, I don't want to be rude or anything, but Just so you know, you pronounce my name, it's Rick Pasek.
Pasek, okay, I'm sorry, Rick.
Oh, no, I can understand why you say it the other way.
So. Okay, I'm not the first, I apologize.
Oh, absolutely not the first.
Okay, so let's talk about dragonflies then.
Okay, so dragonflies, like I said, one of my favorites. I love dragons. The reason I like dragons so much is it's a big meal for them. They love these things. It's a good mouthful. I mean, they don't have to eat a lot of dragons to get full. And they're pretty aggressive. When they do hit a dragon, you better hold on to your rod. So it's something that's fun. Now, dragonflies, their life cycle, they can live anywhere up to 4 years in the lake as a nymph, in the nymphal stage. They go through several instars or molts to grow, just like most insects do. They can be quite large. I mean, I've seen some dragonflies that are 3.5 inches, the nymphs. They can get quite large. They bite, too, so be careful around them, because if you tick them off, they will bite and they hurt. But they have the one thing that is very unique about dragonfly nymphs that every fly fisher needs to know is how they move, because this will tell you how to retrieve your fly. They have a very unique organ in their back end of their abdomen, actually out of their anus. They have like a jet propulsion where they'll suck water in and expel it out their anus. And that will propel them in the water very quickly in short little 4, 6, 8 inch bursts. When they're scared, that's what they use. Normally, they'll just crawl around on the ground. The weeds, chara, they hide their predators. They're one of the apex predators, actually, in the insect world. They'll eat almost anything. Mayfly nymphs, damsel nymphs, scuds, chironomids, bloodworm, anything that comes by that's smaller than them, they're going to attack it. They've got these huge extendable jaws. Actually, if you go onto YouTube, there's a ton of them on YouTube with these extendable jaws that come out, and they actually will reach quite a ways away to get their prey, and then they'll eat them. But the biggest thing to know is how they move. And then once they're ready to hatch, a dragonfly will crawl along the bottom towards shore, towards weeds, towards your anchor rope if you've got one out. Anything that can get them out of the water, they want. So, again, think about that when you're fishing. If you see that there's a dragonfly hatch going on, there's lots of dragons flying around, and you see them, you know that there's a mass migration happening. Park yourself with shore to your back, cast away from shore, and bring that dragonfly nymph towards shore, because that's what it's naturally wanting to do, right? It's trying to get out of the water, trying to get towards those weeds.
When you say you see dragonflies in the air, how long do they live as adults in the air? And you know, what's that relationship to the hatch? Or are you just saying there's activity in the area? They may have hatched yesterday, but there is something going on in the...
Well, quite often, a dragonfly, they don't hang around the water very much. Once they're hatched, they hang around a little bit, and then they go offshore, they go onto land. They mate on land, like when they're flying around, they'll find trees and stuff like that. They'll you know, find themselves a mate and stuff. They can live anywhere up to 2 months. A month is probably more, you know, more average, as the adult. But they can live a lot longer. So if you see them flying around the water, more than likely, they just hatched.
Okay, so around the bank and the edge of the lake, then they're...
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. Like, I mean, I've been out on up at one of the lakes up here. We got one dragonfly that always bugged us. We called him Charlie. I mean, we're out in the water and constantly zoom, zoom, flying around us, right? But, yeah, if you see dragons, I mean, more than likely, they've, if not just hatched, very recently hatched. If it's not within the last 5 minutes, it could be within the last hour. But, again, the hatch will start slowly. You'll get one or two, then you get six, then there's 20, then there's 50, and you'll see them flying around all over the place. Well, you know you're in the middle of a hatch. The adult pattern is not really... The fish don't go after them. So you're targeting the nymphal stage, and the nymphs are crawling on the bottom, trying to find something to crawl out of. So if you've got a weed bed behind you, cast away from the weed bed. I use a sinking line, either a type 3, get it right down close to the bottom, strip it right close to the bottom, or what my favorite is, actually, is using a floating dragon, which is a dragon pattern tied with with deer hair or with furry foam or anything like that to allow it to float. And I'll put that onto a type 6 or even a type 8 sinking line, drag that sinking line right along the ground, but because you've got a floating fly, it wants to be up off of the ground, however, depending on the length of your leader, correct? So as you give it that bang, 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 that twitch, that 4 to 6 inch strip, like 2, 3, 4 of those in a row, it darts down towards the weeds or towards the ground, and then it'll float back up. And then you bang, 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 you strip it in again, mimicking their movement.
Okay. And when you say that the movement, you're doing a crawling thing, then maybe a quick twitch to move it 4 to 6 inches?
Usually what I'm doing is I'm doing a, you know, 12 to 18 inch strip, just, you know, fairly slow. You know, it takes you maybe 3 to 4 seconds to do that strip, another 3 to 4 seconds to do that strip, and then I'll do a quick 4 inch, 4 inch, 4 inch stop. Then I'll do another long 12 to 18 inch strip, another long 12, and mix it up. Don't keep it all the same. Don't make a pattern out of it. Right,
because they do have different activities. Yeah, Mike Holt in Fairfield, Maine wants to know, how deep is too deep for dragonfly nymphs? Is there a certain depth that they don't exist, don't go deeper than?
Well, you'll see the majority of dragons in 8 to 20, 25 feet of water. That's where you're going to see the most of them. Again, if you learn the life cycle of the dragonfly, they need places to hide. They need cover. They need logs. They need sticks. They need weeds because they're ambush hunters. They hide. So with that being said, you want to try to stay in shallower waters where there's going to be those things, the weeds and so on and so forth. Now, I've seen dragons as deep as 30 feet, but I don't usually target anything in deeper water. Fly fishing with a sinking line or a floating line, irrelevant. In anything over 30 feet, it gets more and more and more difficult, right? So.
Okay. Anything else on dragons before we talk about damsels?
Not much, actually. Like I said, just make sure that you hold on. Hold on tight. Now, the one thing that a lot of, and this is very widespread, a lot of people make a big mistake. We have, in the Pacific Northwest, we have two major species. There's hundreds of subspecies, again, of dragonflies all throughout North America. But we have the Darner dragonfly, which is a subspecies. And then we have, in the rivers, which most fly fishermen will know in the rivers, we have the gomphus. Okay, now a lot of people are using what we call a gomphus fly, which is kind of a fatter body, shorter than the Darner. The Darner is a longer, skinnier nymph. The gomphus is a shorter, fatter, almost hourglass-shaped body. They're not in our lakes. A lot of people make that mistake thinking, oh, gomphus, oh, yeah, let's use a gomphus. We don't have gomphus in our lakes. Well, I'll say that different. We have gomphus, but they're very, very, very few. So what we do have that people are mistaking for a gomphus is a sprawler, which is another subspecies. So that's one. Yeah, and they have slightly different habits of how they live and stuff. So do your research on that before you go out, too.
Okay. Talk to us about damsels. That's an important one that you like, I think.
Absolutely. Well, damsels are basically the daintier cousin of the dragon. They are related in the Latin categories. they are actually related species. They go through a similar molts and similar life cycle, 2 to 3 years normally in the water as in the nymphal stage. The only difference is with the dragon, size obviously, they're a lot smaller, daintier. They are ambush hunters again. They will hide in the weeds and in the substrate and in the mud and the logs and stuff like that. And will again ambush hunt scuds, mayflies, chironomids, all that kind of stuff. But the one big difference between a dragon and a damsel is how they hatch. Like I was explaining earlier, a dragonfly will crawl across the bottom, find something, and crawl out. Damselflies, I always, when I do my seminars, I always call it suicide. I mean, insect suicide. Because what they do is, let's say they're hanging out, their area, their home is in a weed bed that's in 16 feet of water, offshore. It's not right on the shore. Okay, there's an underwater weed bed somewhere. That's where they live. Time to hatch. They don't go across the bottom. They're dumb. They go straight up the water column. Straight up the water column until they're somewhere around 12 to 18 inches below the surface. And now they will cross the water to go and find something to crawl out of. So they're leaving themselves wide open to predation. And that's one thing to remember with a damsel opposed to a dragon. So with a damsel, quite often I will fish them with a slime line or a type 1 intermediate sink. I do a really slow, these are very dainty. They kind of got a, I don't know, it's kind of hard to explain, a worm-like or a herring. Like they move very twitchy. They use those three little paddle tails that they have, their gills, to move. And they kind of wriggle their bodies back and forth. They're not very fast movers, so they're quite open to predation in that way, right? So, but I would say my favorite, once I know there's a damsel hatch happening, and I mean, they're not hard to find because they're usually en masse. They're huge.
Okay.
You won't just see one or two. You'll see 200 or 300 flying around. So you know there's a hatch happening. I like doing a... Like the fly that I explained earlier, a little damsel nymph with some marabou on its tail for that nice movement, that nice, you know, flowing movement in the water, some bead chain eyes or some mono eyes, something like that with a usually a marabou body, some legs coming off of it, floating line, again shore or weed bed to your back, cast it out and I use a floating line and I just want this thing just to sink. 8, 10, 12 inches below the water, and I do a really slow, again, 12 to 20-inch strip, and do it nice and slow. That 12 to 20-inch strip should take you 6 to 8 seconds, nice and slow, because they don't move that fast, right? And because that's their typical habit of when they want to hatch, is they come straight up and across, so that's what you're trying to mimic. Come up, and then you want to be right below the surface, bringing it towards shore.
Now, for dragons and damsels, what about adults in the surface? Do you have much success with fishing adults in the surface?
Dragons, never had one fish on a dragon adult personally. I have heard of some people having some limited success with them. Damsels, absolutely. They're a lot smaller. They're easier for the trout to catch because quite often, again, now we get back to what you were talking about earlier. Remember you were saying when the caddisflies come and dip their abdomens?
Right.
Well, damsels, what they'll do is they'll come fly back to a weed bed somewhere, crawl down the weed, and put their abdomen into the water and lay their eggs on the weed just subsurface.
They're vulnerable then.
Exactly. They're very vulnerable. They're just sitting there waiting. So, you know, quite often, unfortunately, you'll lose a lot of flies because you got to cast your fly right into the weeds. So, I mean, if you've got bulrush or chara or anything like that sticking out, I mean, you've got to find that little pocket in between and just that really accurate little flip cast right into there and then just let it sit there, maybe do a little twitch here and there as if it fell off of one of the weeds and is, you know, stuck in the water. So I have had success with adult damsels. Don't do it very often. I find I have way more success with the nymph, so... Yep. Why would I switch it out to have the adult?
Right, right. Okay, right. We're running short on time here, Rick, but we want to cover scuds. So if you can tell us a bit about your experiences with scuds and then just quickly touch on things like, you know, and I know there's many others that we're not going to touch tonight, but we did have a couple questions about how important water boatmen and how important mayflies are in still waters. But I know you feel scuds are more important than those two, so why don't you start with that?
Absolutely. Scuds are probably, chironomids and scuds are probably the number one and number two food source in most lakes, at least here in the Pacific Northwest and Western Canada. Now, I know there's scuds all throughout North America, so they're extremely important. It's a huge, huge food source for the trout. As a matter of fact, for the listeners, if they want to go to Phil Rowley's site, flycraftangling.com, he's actually got a pie chart of the diets of the trout. Excellent pie chart. You know, springtime, wintertime, fall, summer, the whole bit. And just by his chart here, just so you can have an idea, Chironomids 50%, Scuds 18% in the springtime of their diet. And then it goes right down, damsels of 9%, dragons 5, leeches 3. So it shows you right there. And that's like that all throughout the year. It's Chironomids, then Scuds, and then everything else.
That's good to know, yeah.
Yeah, it's an extremely, extremely important food source to trout. Now, scuds are not, I'll have to admit, they're not my favorite to fish. I have had very good success with them, but the I don't know, the trout, they can gorge themselves on scuds, and then they're just turned right off of them, right? So it's one of those, if you catch it at the right time, you can have a phenomenal day, but it can be a little tough. Again, if you're going to fish a scud is, how do you want to say, a lot of people think it's a shrimp. That's when you're talking and people you're talking to people on the lake or whatever, and they're like, well, hey, how would you have success with? Oh, a shrimp. No, we don't have shrimp in our waters. They're scuds. Scuds are not shrimp. They're two different species. Most people think they are, but they're not. So they look like a shrimp, like a tiny little freshwater shrimp, but they're not.
But they are a crustacean, rather.
Correct. They are a crustacean, but they're not a shrimp.
Right.
So, but they're very erratic movers. A lot of times they will move a lot. They'll swim a lot on their sides. So you'll see that a lot. So it's tough to mimic them. The success I have found that I've had a lot of success with is fishing a scud the same way I fish a chironomid. Under an indicator, floating line, right close to the weeds. And then just do the same figure eight retrieve with a twitch, 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 and then stop. And then a figure eight retrieve again, twitch, twitch, twitch. So that's, it, for me, that has always been the most successful way of fishing scuds. Now, if they're on, I mean, you can have one heck of a day. But sometimes that can be really tough to figure out when they're eating scuds, so.
And since they're crustaceans, we really don't have a hatch going on or anything. They're just always there.
Correct.
Yeah.
Well, just so all the listeners know, the following, dragons, damsels, chironomids, leeches, scuds, boatmen, mayflies, caddisflies, they're always in the water. They're always there. 12 months of the year, 375 days of the year, they're there. 365, sorry guys, I added 10 days, didn't I? they're always in the water and available to trout. But because in the wintertime there's limited activity to certain insects, there's obviously limited chance for the trout to feed on them, right? So it all depends. It just depends on how it's going. But they are always in the water. But hatching-wise, no, scuds do not hatch. They don't. It doesn't happen. They're a crustacean. They're in the water. They're swimming around. So
and the trout or bass or whatever fish that's feeding on them are opportunistic in that respect, I assume, in that if there's more of a quantity of one thing and they're easier to get, then that's what they're going to be going after.
That is usually the case. Sometimes it's not. I would say 85 to 90% of the time that's the case. Hey, there's a scud in front of me. Hump, I'm going to eat it. Sometimes there's like, no, there's a scud in front. I don't feel like scud. they actually do. They don't feel like filet mignon tonight. They want to have a T-bone, right?
Okay. With that said, why don't you touch real quickly on importance of water boat and mayflies? I think you've kind of already made your point that, you know, the chironomids and scuds are the top producers out there.
Absolutely, they are.
Real quick, because we're just about out of time here.
So. Okay, well, just so you can say, mayflies, here it shows that in the diet, 2%. In the summertime, 2% of their trout's diet is mayflies in the lakes. And as you and I discussed earlier this afternoon, mayflies are not an important part in the lakes. They're very important in the rivers, not that important in the lakes. We do have two main species of mayflies here, which is Calabatus and Hexagena. But again, 1,500 subspecies throughout North America, and they're different everywhere. Everywhere you go, there's a different subspecies. So that's more predominant than the other. Mayflies, I don't know. I've never had, and I've tried. I've dedicated, something I do every year is I dedicate this summer, like this year, I dedicate it to a type of bug. And I learn everything I can, and that's all I try to fish. Last year was my chironomid year. This year is going to be my scud year. I'm doing nothing but scuds this year to learn all kinds of different techniques and stuff. Something I've always done. Every year I pick a different bug and really concentrate on them. Mayflies I did about 4 years ago, and very, very limited success. They're not there. They're just not as prolific as they are in the rivers. So I don't concentrate much on them. And in all honesty, for stillwaters, there's really not a lot. Especially for a beginner, you're really going to frustrate yourself if you're going to try to target mayflies, because it's not that predominant.
Well, Rick, we need to tie things up here. There was a question came in, and we didn't really address this earlier, and I noticed that your new insect guide is now not out on Amazon yet. Your other book is. So where can people get your new book?
Well, they can go to their local fly shops. I do have a distributor down in the U.S. Also, up here in Canada, Chapters, Black Bond, they all carry them. Or they can just go to my website at www.rp3flyfishing.com, order it, and I'll ship it to them. That's for now. It is going to get into more stores and stuff. That takes time, right? So.
Oh, sure. I mean, it just came out. Understandable.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, we are out of time, but stick with us here. We're going to be giving away a 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, a 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine, and the autographed copies of Rick's books, The Freshman Fly Fisher and The Freshman Fly Fisher's Insect Guide. So you'll get 2 books when you win this. So stick with us, and we'll be giving those away shortly. The Bristol Bay region of southwest Alaska is home to the largest runs of wild salmon on the planet and some of the best trophy rainbow trout fishing found anywhere. The Pebble Mine still remains a threat to the region, and 2 million acres of federal lands may also be at risk. The entire fly fishing industry has united in this epic conservation battle. Anglers from across the country are joining the fight. Be one of them. Visit www.savebristolbay.org. That's www.savebristolbay.org to learn more and to get involved. Now, just a quick reminder to everyone before you leave our website tonight, just take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. Right in there under Rick's section, it says, what do you think of the show? Just click on that when we're finished here and leave your comments. We'd really appreciate it. Now, the winners of our drawings are randomly selected from the show's registration database. If you didn't register for tonight's show already, it's a little late now, but make sure you do so on the next one, because we're always giving away some nice gifts. If you're the lucky winner tonight, or one of the winners tonight, you will be contacted after the show for you to provide us with the information we need for us to give you your gift. So first, we're going to give away a membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, and this is always a great gift to give away. The Federation is a great organization, and getting a membership there will help you in a number of ways. If you want to find out more about the Federation, go to fedflyfishers.org. That's fedflyfishers.org. So I'm going to pick my winner here randomly from our database, and it is Larry Hull in Michigan. Larry Hull in Michigan. So, Larry, congratulations on winning that 3-year membership. If you already have one, we'll get that extended for you as well. So we should have your email address, and we'll be contacting you for receiving that prize. And now we're going to give away 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine, which is, if you'd like to learn more about them, it's www.flyfusionmag.com. That's flyfusionmag.com. Great magazine out of Calgary, Canada, and lots of pictures, lots of how-to information articles in there. So our winner is, while we're waiting for that, let's talk about the prizes that Rick has so kindly offered up. Is the freshman fly fisher and the freshman fly fisher's insect guide. So what we're going to do is I'm going to pose one question. The first and the second correct winners will receive both the books as a little package. And Rick's just told you, in case you're not one of the lucky winners, you know where to get them now at his website. So let's see here. The question that is going to, we'll come back to the winner of the Fly Fusion, but since my computer is being stubborn at the moment, we'll come back. Here we go. Got it. Greg Bennett in Washington. Greg Bennett in Washington is the winner of the magazine subscription to Fly Fusion. So thanks for playing, Greg, and we'll contact you in that regard. Okay, so the question tonight, to get Rick's books, he talked twice about a specific retrieve he used for chironomids and for scuds. And a specific retrieve he used, what is the term he used for that retrieve? Okay, what is the name of the retrieve they use for chironomids and scuds. So, Rick, I'm checking here to see who has sent in, and I'll let you determine what that correct answer is. And it usually takes us a few seconds. Our first answer is from Doug, and he's in BC, Vancouver Island, and he says the figure eight. Is that the one I was talking about?
That's the one.
That's the one, yeah. Okay, so Doug, you've got a set of Rick's books, and now I'll check to see if we've got a second winner here. And we've got, we do, I think, Pete Suska in Wethersfield, Connecticut. He says figure eight, too. So we got our two winners on the first two tries. That's great. Our people were listening tonight.
There you go. That's good.
Good. So, Pete and Doug, please send me your contact information, your mailing address, email address, and you can do it in the same box you just did it in. So send me that information so that Rick can send you out the books. So congratulations to both of you two. I know you're going to love his books. And like we said, hey, you're going to be one of the first to get this insect guide since it's so brand spanking new. So anyway, thanks for playing, guys. And Rick, appreciate you being on the show with us tonight. It was fun. We ran out of time, as we always do, more to talk about, and always food for another show, huh?
Exactly. Well, thank you very, very much for having me. I really, really had a good time, and hopefully the listeners actually listened well and got some good information out of that, and that'll help them, with more luck in the future.
Yeah, practice makes perfect, right?
Absolutely. And if I can leave the listeners with one last thing.
Sure.
Make sure you pay attention to what's going on around you. Be aware of your surroundings at all times. If you're aware of what's happening, you'll have more success.
Terrific. Good words of advice. Well, our next broadcast will be on April 15th at 7 p.m. Mountain Time and 9 p.m. Eastern Time. And on that show, we'll interview Paul Weimer, and our topic for the show will be fly fishing the Upper Delaware River. Now, Paul Weimer has spent over a decade fishing the Upper Delaware River watershed, where the trout are large, wild, and highly selective. Be sure to listen into our next show where you'll find out more about this great fishery and the special techniques he uses to hook up with these trophies. We'd like to thank Federation of Fly Fishers, Fly Fusion Magazine, Keeney's Fly Shop, Royal Gorge Anglers, and Women's Fly Fishing Alaska for sponsoring our show tonight. If you think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-888-961-1115. That's 888-961-1115, extension 2, and we'll be happy to explain the options to you. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.